is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Outloud. Well, what seems like a slow motion movie, the Socialist Democrats have made their case. Up next is the RNC, and President Trump will now make their case to the nation. There's a lot to talk about with the DNC and the convention. It was very low viewership. We'll discuss all the implications of that. Also, you know, all these months later, after the pandemic, I think the big question Americans are asking is, why are there still not enough paper towels and toilet paper to go around? Maybe that's a question we need to find an answer to, huh? And then the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, assures Congress everything is good. Very political, the whole post office, mail-in ballot, universal, you know, you heard the argument versus absentee voting, of course. Steve Bannon charged with misusing donations for the border wall. It's a big story with wide-reaching implications there. And then the great gamble of COVID-19 vaccine development. We'll have Dr. Peter McCall with us later, and we'll touch on a lot of things about this vaccine coming. And don't forget the second hour again with Michael Johns. We have a lot to talk about there. Let's start at the top of the program here. Welcome on Dinesh D'Souza. And let me just tell you, I mean, many of you may know, but Dinesh actually was born in Bombay, India, if you didn't know that or don't remember. He moved to the United States as an exchange student. And I say that for a couple of reasons here. He became a naturalized citizen in 1991. He's an author, a filmmaker, really a storyteller of truth. But mostly, I would suggest to you, Dinesh is an American patriot. And I think everybody who knows him knows exactly that. There is a new movie coming out, which is timed just perfectly before the election, we'll touch on, called Trump Card. Quite something. Very dramatic trailer to it. Let's start here, Dinesh. So the DNC. So about 24.6 million TV viewers tuned into that last night to hear Biden. That was the most watched night, was the last evening of the convention. And where is he accepted the nomination, and this was after, you know, the four-day event. Now, viewership decreased in this about 17% from the audience that watched Hillary Clinton, except in 2016. So the whole essence here is dark versus light. It's all about the darkness. Many people would argue the darkness of the civil unrest in America's cities being destroyed and the pandemic plague out of China, which both could be tied to the Socialist Democrat Party, of course. So potentially they're touting the darkness. But my question is, are they part and parcel responsible for some of that darkness? And did the DNC make the case, in your opinion, to America?
I think the problem with the argument that was made at many different levels during the DNC convention was that it presumed the thing that it was supposed to prove. In other words, its premise is that Trump is horrible. The country is in a miserable state. To re-elect Trump is to get more of the same. Now, if you already thought those things, then the DNC would be merely reaffirming them. But if you didn't know or you didn't think that, they didn't do much of a job at all to convince you. They didn't even try. It wasn't that they laid out the indictment against Trump and said, listen, here is how Trump has failed. Here's how we could have done better with the pandemic. Here's why this is such a dark time to live in America. In many cases, you got the feeling that the problems that they described, civil unrest and so on, were problems of their making. This isn't something that Trump whipped up. It's almost like Trump sends in the federal troops to calm the place down, and the Democrats go, look, 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 you're the problem. This is making a confusion between the cops and the burglars, and pretending that the cops who come to clean up the place are the ones who actually did the burglary in the first place. So the whole thing had a slightly surreal quality for someone like me who doesn't agree with the premises, but was open to hearing information and even being convinced to a degree. I found this to be a pathetic spectacle.
Yeah, well, President Trump did as well. He slammed the Democrats for hosting the darkest Democrat convention, saying that the former Vice President Joe Biden sees American darkness, yet he sees American greatness. And the president does talk a great deal about, I mean, he's one of the, probably, as I said the other day on my program, Dinesh, probably one of the only presidents we can recall who walks into a room and can't help himself but to hug the flag. Very unusual for any politician to do that. But this one does it very naturally. He is obviously a patriot here. We talk about this darkness and the, you say surreal. That's a good word to use, actually. It is surreal. And I think, quite frankly, the majority of Americans would also feel it. Some it's a nightmare, a dream, but surreal is a good word because I think a lot of people can't believe this is all happening to our nation. I received a message yesterday, and I want you to respond to this. It caught me by surprise. It was from a journalist and a colleague out of Europe. And I hadn't talked to this person in quite some time, actually. And here was the message. World situation is insane, Malcolm, and I believe civil war could break out in the U.S. very soon. In the United States, I see a similar situation, which very much reminds me of the early stages of the revolution in Russia. And I'm alarmed. The U.S. could turn Marxist. You gotta fight. 3 exclamation marks after that. Well, this person doesn't normally send those kind of messages, so it got my attention as to how people perceive us in other areas of the world. Comment on that particular response and how they put that out there.
Well, I think that socialism has entered the American mainstream in a way that it hasn't before in American history. There were socialist candidates who ran before, but they were very marginal. And but now we have socialism in the Democratic bloodstream. Biden doesn't call himself a socialist, but he's embraced much of the socialist agenda, from free college to the Green New Deal. Now, the socialism that at least young people in America have in mind is not the socialism of Lenin or Mao. It's a kind of very confused and selfish type of socialism. And what I mean by that is, if you say to a young person, hey, listen, you know, your mom and dad were going to buy you a new car, but since you are a beneficiary of white privilege, how about if they give the money to the government instead to help some deserving minority instead of you? All these young people will go, no, you can't do that. I'm entitled to my new car. So it's not that they want to give up privileges themselves, even though they profess to be the beneficiaries of white privilege. Now, on the other side of the coin, if you said to the same young person, we're going to catch some millionaire or billionaire and pick his pocket and make him pay for your house or car or college education, then the same kid would go, wow, that sounds like a pretty good deal to me. So what you have here is a certain intellectual and emotional immaturity, a willingness to demand sacrifices of others that you're not willing to make for yourself. And to some degree, I see socialism as the product of this pampered, spoiled generation that has been mentally debilitated by its own teachers and professors and indulged a little too much by its own parents.
Yeah, that is a very good descriptive, because a lot of people are trying to figure out and understand what went wrong with Generation Z and the millennials, for that matter. But it has been a drip, 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 and it's been coming on for many years, which really is part of the problem. A lot of this is put on President Trump, like somehow he bought this all up. But this has all been invented in the past 3.5 years, yet it's taken over the last 50 years for it to make its creep into society, as you say, where socialism is now being accepted, which is really communism, but nobody wants to really say that, but I'm happy to inform folks. I think what the bigger problem, Dinesh, were this, the back to the surreal moment here, something I've been reporting on for some years, and many of my listeners know how I feel about our America's cities. Now, before this current decline, you know, I have seen that our cities have been in a heap of trouble for a very long time, and sadly, and what's taken place is it's like that frog in the water story. It's just, it's been a creep onto American society. Yet I can't seem to understand. We've been trying to wake Americans up to understand who's running these cities that are declining in such a rapid rate. Because, you know, at the end of the day, the MAGA movement is running around with Make America Great Again. And that's a whole movement unto itself in our nation. But yet you can't make America great without great American cities. Talk about the Democrat stronghold on America's cities. And I think this was part of really your message, I believe, with the film Trump Card. But talk about that, the stronghold. Why is it Americans can't see this in plain daylight? And even the people who live in these cities, in the decline of life in Seattle and Portland and Chicago and New York and Charleston and smaller cities. I mean, it's not just the big cities.
Yeah, I think that the if you take New York as the sort of greatest and most maybe prototypical of all the cities, you find that the white liberals who vote for Democrats in New York, many of them don't live in New York. Or if they live in New York, they live in a sort of other New York that is insulated from the debris of New York, the rundown of New York. So the Democrats kind of have it good because they've got a sort of indigenous population, if you can call it, and I'm talking about an indigenous population of poor blacks and poor Hispanics and poor whites. And what they do is they create a sort of cordon of dependency. They ruin these places. There's a political benefit that comes out of the ruin. The political benefit is that you have a dependent population that feels like it has nowhere else to go and relies on the Democrats to provide a basic, meager subsistence living. And in exchange for that, it's a pretty clear understanding that these cities have to deliver a 90% plus Democratic vote. So as long as they do that, the Democrats are never going to change because they've got a political monopoly in these places that dwarfs almost anything else in American politics. Why would you give up a constituency that's delivering for you 9 out of 10 votes?
Yeah. So they're brainwashing the public. I mean, on every level, everything we're talking about today here is really, that is the denominator. They're very effective at brainwashing these last couple of generations into thinking things that clearly aren't true. So to the cities, to the point of the cities now, I mean, where do you see this going now? I mean, right now as we see, I mean, you've got crime escalating in New York itself. That is what, up around 30-35%. And it's steadily going upward. And the increase, and then you've got the defunding and abolishing the police on the other side, which you can't, you know, connect the two. It doesn't make any sense. Do you see at some point people are going to hit back on this thing? I mean, what's your gut tell you? I mean, how far low do we go before we start to come back?
Well, my gut tells me it can go either way. And I also think that we have generally a certain type of optimism. For example, we'll say things like, well, this is unsustainable, as if to say that there's some law of nature that's going to make the ball that hit the ground automatically bounce up. But that's not the case. Sometimes things do not bounce up. Look, for example, at Detroit. Property values in Detroit now are not substantially higher than they were 40 years ago. So you've basically had a city that has been wrecked, but it never bounced back. There have been certain areas of Detroit that might have had a surge, but by and large, as a whole, the city is a ruin. And that is always an option for where these places are going to go. So I think, look, there aren't enough Republicans or conservatives to step up and say, look, it's time to give us a chance. Ultimately, if the city is going to be saved, it's going to have to be saved by sensible Democrats who say, look, this is not really what we voted for. We want livable places to be successful with our businesses and to raise our families. We want good education. So a guy like de Blasio is actually, I think in the end, screwing over his own party. And this is what socialism does. Ultimately, it makes life miserable, even for the people who vote for it. And the people who vote for it need to turn around and throw the bums out. So that's what I'm kind of waiting for, is to see if Democrats wake up. Or the other option, they've been too indoctrinated. They think the solution is to get someone even more left-wing than de Blasio. Remember, some of these progressive guys who are to the left of the mayor of Portland, to the left of the mayor of Seattle, to the left of the de Blasio, are putting themselves forward as the solution. So things could actually get worse.
Yeah, no, that is perfect. Because again, Detroit is an interesting example to use, because you don't think of Detroit like that. Like, nobody would say, well, could that happen to our country? I mean, but yet you're saying, well, of course it could. I mean, and like you said, there is no law that says once it hits rock bottom that, oh, okay, I mean, it's all good. That should give every American pause right now. Now, my attempt here is to wake people up. And it really is not to push off. Dinesh, I don't think the answer for the conservative movement and the patriots in America is to piss off the entire left and the moderates. We've got to attract the moderates, the independents, the left of center, those middle-of-the-road Democrats who also love their country and are looking back for the party of JFK, but it is long gone in history. I think on the other side of this story, the Democrat Party could be at its end as well. I mean, it could expire after this next election or two. What do you think about that?
That has happened in American politics, sure. And it happens quite suddenly. Mm-hmm. It happened to the Whig Party in the 19th century. The Whig Party was a viable party. It had put people in the White House. It had it was the main rival to the Democratic Party. And yet it ultimately and very quickly collapsed. And then for a while, there were multiple parties. And then out of that came the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And so things can change pretty dramatically. And the Democratic Party, I think, has become gangsterized. That's probably the big difference. That's a lot of people don't realize that that is a change from the Democratic Party of, say, 30 or 40 years ago. Jimmy Carter was a nincompoop, but he wasn't a gangster. Mm-hmm. No one would say that Truman was a gangster. But under Obama and Hillary, the Democratic Party has taken on a gangster quality. And by that, I mean, I'm referring to the use of the government, the police agencies of government against political opponents. I'm also talking about with the Clinton Foundation and the Biden kind of family crime racket, this idea of using your office to enrich yourself to gargantuan levels, take massive payments from foreign governments that are generally done, in Biden's case, legally. But essentially what happens is Biden gets around all the disclosure requirements because all the deals are made with his brother, James Biden, or his other brother, Frank Biden, or his son, Hunter Biden. So the money comes into the Biden family. It just doesn't come in under Joe Biden's name.
Let's talk about the Trump card. You've got here, I mean, you, to remind folks, you are also the filmmaker of the 2016 Obama's America and Hillary's America. And now we've got the Trump card, which is, I understand, going to be out on October 9th on demand. We'll touch on that. But you say in here, you say we are in a cold civil war, and you talk about beating us into submission. And again, as you've already laid out, well, I mean, listen. I mean, if you create the problem, and they're very good, Marxist, socialist Democrats are very, very effective at creating the problem. But the other bigger problem than that is they own the megaphone to the problem. They own all of the operations of social media and media and all of the empires of universities. And so that's where I think patriots, that's what scares me the most and what puts our country in such a delicate situation right now, I think. So when you talk about this cold civil war and the beaten into submission, tell us about the film, and you've released this right on the eve. I mean, my golly, right on the eve of the election, obviously strategic in nature, I assume, and hopefully everybody's talking about this between October 9th and November 3rd.
Yeah, I think it's my my most powerful movie. I had planned to release it in August in 1,000 theaters, but not enough theaters are open. And so I didn't want to have the phenomenon where it's showing in some parts of the country, but not others. And people get really frustrated. I can't see it and so on. So I thought, look, I'd rather regroup, release it on video on demand and all these different platforms from Apple iTunes to Google Play, Amazon Prime, the whole gamut. So anyone can see it and they can see it on any device from the computer to your big screen TV to your phone. You'll be able to get the movie any which way and everyone will be able to see it. The movie itself exposes the Democratic left, the socialist left, both in its ideas and its tactics. And when I talk about the fact that they're trying to intimidate us, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, for many people in America, today, there's no free speech. I mean, there's no effective free speech. Why? Because if you actually speak out, number one, you're going to be at risk for your job. You work in a place where your employer is going to call you in and demote you or fire you. If you're on social media, they can ban you and make you a sort of digital non-person, if you will. If you're in the government, you're obviously vulnerable. If you're a university, your professor can knock you down a grade, or you can be called in before this college judiciary committee for a hate offense. So what this really means is that even though we are in a theoretically free country, many, many people, perhaps a majority, have to watch what they say, even in the ordinary circles that they live in. Now, this goes beyond the left owning the media or academia. It ultimately means that our first freedom, the First Amendment, is, in a sense, inoperative in large sectors of American life. We just put out the trailer. Trump tweeted it out. It's over, you know, 1 million views on Twitter in one day. So there's a lot of excitement, because I think that the narrative that we put out in the movie does not exist anywhere else.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist not only on the liberal outlets for sure, but even on the conservative outlets.
Right.
And so this provides a very powerful type of way for people to get entertained at the same time that they're getting enlightened.
You're getting informed, really, yeah. Listen, the trailer is very effective. I mean, it really leaves you in suspense. You've done a great job with that, without a doubt here. The other thing I believe is courageous about what you've done here is that really in an interesting sort of way, you're using their medium, which is the Hollywood, the movie factor, and you're brave enough and courageous to get in there and use those tools to be able to get a good patriotic message out. So we are hoping for good success for you there. And finally, in the last moment here, we talk about the American dream, and you talk about the American dream being at stake, and I think a lot of our listeners feel that it is at stake right now. And I think the underlying point of all of these things we've just talked about is that the Marxists are on the move, Dinesh. Without a doubt, like you said, the gangster is an interesting way to put a lot of the political figures on the far left. That combined with the gangster mentality and outside influences have probably created this perfect storm right now, which people should not ignore. Your lasting message to we the people.
Sometimes the threat to America comes from the outside, but in this case, it comes from the inside. And that's why I use the phrase a cold civil war, because sort of like in the 1850s, we're facing a domestic insurgency. I mean, you can look at the Antifa rioters and looters as just a symbol of a broader domestic insurgency. And it's one that seeks to subvert our liberties, change the America that we know. That's why they're pulling the monuments down, because the monuments stand for an America that they hate. It's very important for us to use our influence in fighting this. Most people use a very tiny portion of their influence, and they say things like, well, what can I do? Well, the reason I made a film is to say, listen, I've already created the messaging. I've got investors to put in millions of dollars. I've made a really good movie. Now, the least you can do is help me get this message out, share it with people, push it out there so that millions of people can watch it. It can make a huge difference if you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will do exactly that here. We are in a motion here, my fellow Americans. A full frontal assault is upon us here. And there is a lot, a great deal at stake. A big thank you to Dinesh D'Souza to kick off our two-hour program here on Viewpoint. And up next now, let's talk with Bob France and get into some of these other stories with Bannon and the post office and the rest of it. A lot more Viewpoint ahead. Stay right there. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
Join you back on Viewpoint. And well, listen, I think one of the biggest questions, as I mentioned to you up top of the program, is that Americans want to know is, why is there still not enough toilet paper and paper towels to go around, is what folks are really asking about the pandemic. And well, the Wall Street Journal says the United States, heralded as the land of plenty, still doesn't have enough paper towels or toilet paper. Long after the coronavirus sparked a run on them, retailers can't keep the shelves full. And listen to this a moment. This is crazy here. Target says they are out of them. They ran all through their Bounty paper towels, but Amazon, they were charging $44.95 for a pack that normally goes for $15. Wow. That's called price gouging right there. But a lot of this comes to the hyper-efficiency of manufacturers when you read behind this whole story, and that people, these manufacturers just weren't leaving a lot on the shelves. That, all, you know, remember happened back in the 80s, 70s, and 80s from Japan, that whole, and that impacted our manufacturing here in the States, and that should explain to everybody, and now put that to rest here. Now let's bring on here Bob France, and Bob is the morning news talk host at WHKAM in 1420 Cleveland on Salem Media. Excited to have Bob here with us. And Bob, first of all, before I talk about the DNC, I got to get a comment. What's going on with in your world with the paper towels and toilet paper?
You know what? That mess ended a long time ago. As far as I'm concerned, we have had no problem at all. As a matter of fact, I went into a Sam's Club last week to pick up paper towels. We get them by the great big, volume of them that they sell at the big box stores like that. And the shelves were empty, or the pallets were empty. So all you do is you ask a worker, "Hey, you got any more of those in the back?" "Sure do. We'll bring them out." Anyway, and I walked out. So, you know, I think sometimes this is over embellished a little bit, these shortages. I think sometimes the price gouging is real when there are shortages on these things. And that is a criminal act to do to people right now who are struggling with their work hours if they haven't already been furloughed or laid off anyway. But for me, in my little corner of the world, we haven't had any problems.
There you go. All right. Let's talk about the DNC and Joe Biden's speech. And so the president says, and I quote, "Four straight days attacking America as a racist, horrible country that must be redeemed." Yeah, President Trump said it was the darkest, gloomiest convention he had ever seen. He said Biden grimly declared a season of American darkness, but look at what we've accomplished until the plague came in, and look what we're doing again. What is your honest takeaway that not only did you take away, but how do you think America, I mean, there we obviously have two camps. We have a socialist Marxist camp, and we have a free, loving American patriot camp. But how do you think America took that speech with Biden on the fourth day there of the convention?
Well, you know, you're right to say that there are two Americas right now. And I'm not saying it's at the level of the Civil War, but there are really two different countries right now. It's just they're not divided north, south, or east, or west. It's kind of coastal, and then there's the middle. And most of the former you referenced are on the coast, and they love the speech because they agreed with every single lie that was told, not just by Joe Biden on day four, but by Jill Biden, by Michelle Obama, Barack Obama, Kamala Harris, the entire gamut. They believe every lie that was told about Donald Trump. And then in real America, the America that is, you know, still believes in capitalism, still believes in a representative constitutional republic, they recognize those lies for what they are. Look, what really struck me in the fourth day is not the content of Joe Biden's speech, because I feel like it was just more generalities, no actual solutions. I mean, his economic plan is to build back better. That's it. Build back better. Really? Okay, how are you going to do that? Well, I'm going to raise taxes on everybody, on every small business. Businesses that are already struggling extraordinarily, the ones that are still alive. And we don't know by the time all of the lockdowns or the reduced hours or reduced drinking times, et cetera, for bars and restaurants. We don't even know how much longer that's going to last in the blue states where the governors are still heavy-handed. But all of these small businesses are already suffering and struggling, and many of them going out of business permanently. And Joe Biden's plan is we're going to overtax all of them, as well as just about every American, and that's going to help us build back better. But all of that content, honestly, is second to the fact that the media was crying tears of joy that he didn't trip and fumble over himself reading a teleprompter speech. I mean, literally, I heard at least three different national journalists say that Joe Biden blew a great big hole in the narrative that he has lost his fastball, that he doesn't have the cognitive ability that he once did, blah, blah, blah. As if this is what, you know, the test of that is. All Joe Biden proved that he could do was read.
He read a teleprompter.
Teleprompter. He read a scrolling script in front of him. That doesn't blow a hole in anything. Let's see how he answers unscripted questions.
Exactly.
Let's see if he remembers where he is. Let's see if he remembers those things in a setting that actually isn't already.
Well, Bob, that was Chris Wallace's comment, too, about the blowing the hole in the air. And, of course, Fox has irritated a lot of conservatives out there for a lot of reasons. And people like Wallace, who seem to play to the narrative that you just explained and described. But the bar was incredibly low for that, because, listen, here's the why it is. It really, you have to admit, Bob, the people that are handling Biden have played this thing to a T. It is the most orchestrated program ever. In other words, we haven't seen a piece of Biden. So the bar was so low, we didn't even know if the guy was still living or breathing, for heaven's sakes, until we seen him there. And there was, oh, the guy is alive. There you go, man. Okay. And he can talk too. Damn. Wow. I mean, that's what happened, isn't it? I mean.
Well, yeah, it is. And I'll tell you something else. What really concerns me is they have set that bar so low for his speech. Right. I fear that that's going to be the same low bar during the debates. He doesn't have to defeat Donald Trump on the points, on the policies. He just has to stand there, not stab himself with a pen, not break his leg on the way to the podium. And as long as he is able to fog a mirror, they'll say he did a great job. They have set the bar so low for Joe Biden.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Let's talk about the Postmaster General. It's another big story this week here with Louis DeJoy. He is the Postmaster General. He assures Congress. He testified before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. DeJoy says, in a quote, "As we head into the election season, I want to assure this committee and the American public that the Postal Service is fully capable of delivering the nation's election mail securely and on time." Now, this has become a big issue because of the misnomer, Bob, and all the confusion and the craziness with the media and political operatives about universal mail-out ballot, where you just drop them from airplanes from coast to coast and let people pick them off the ground like you were in the war of some sort, versus the absentee legitimate mail-in voting. There's a complete confusion for probably most of America, still doesn't understand the difference between the two. Now, the Postmaster General was hired to make a lot of changes in there because the post office is one of the most disorganized and inept organizations in the country. It's a weird relationship they have with the government to begin with, because they're sort of a sister stepchild outside of the normal stream of things. What was your take on DeJoy, his message to Congress, and the result of this whole mail-in voting fiasco, Bob?
Well, I'll be honest with you. It's more than just overblown. I think it's a non-story. The post office part of this. Wow. The real threat of all mail-in voting isn't whether or not the post office can handle it, although that is, you know, as you pointed out, historically a very inept and a very, poorly run part of the federal government. So I do think there is a concern there. But the real reason we are afraid, or I'm afraid, and I think President Trump has explained why, when they ask him, will you accept the results of the election? And he says, I don't know. And it's because I don't know who is getting those ballots. The post office may be wonderful and deliver all of them to the address to which, that is stamped on the outside of the envelope. But who's in that house? Is it the same voter with the name on it? Did that person move? Did that person die? Is that person a person, or is it a dog or a cat? And I say these things not joking, because they have all happened. So mail-in voting is just ripe for fraud. I feel and fear as though there will be Democrats literally going mailbox to mailbox, especially in rural communities, which A, have postal boxes on the road and you don't have to come up to somebody's home. You can take them easily. And B, rural areas generally vote red. So I am terribly, terribly afraid.
Well, Bob, what you just say there about the mailboxes, Bob, wouldn't that be the same thing of various people in, like you say, communities, even, and this happens every day, where they go into the neighbor's yards or the other yards and they remove the signs from the opponent they don't like.
Yeah, they do that.
Right, this is just one step removed from that. What the hell difference does it make? I mean, right? No,
that is 1,000% true. And look, you know, these people, the Democrats cannot be trusted. And here's the way I would say this, and I'm stealing this from somebody who said it to me, and I think it's brilliant. Take a significant amount of money to you. I don't know what your income level is. You don't know what mine is, but take whatever that significant amount of money is. Let's say it's $5,000. It's a very significant amount of money to you. You cannot afford to lose $5,000. Would you be willing right now to put $5,000 in cash in an envelope, drop it in a U.S. post box, and send it to yourself, trusting that you'll get it back? Because if you are afraid of putting $5,000 cash in the mail, then you doggone well do not want to put your vote in the mail.
That is very well said. It gives you food for thought for sure there. Edith Sitchers, there's a whole lot more about that post office, but quite something. Let's talk about this other big story. I really want to get your thoughts and opinions on Steve Bannon. This was a wow moment for conservatives. About everywhere here. He was arrested for misusing donations for the border wall. This was that Bill, We Build the Wall campaign. There were four people involved with this, and the founder of it was the military vet, the Kolfage there. You know who I'm speaking about.
Sure, the Air Force
veteran who lost both his legs and his right arm in his deployment in Iraq. It's quite a unique story. I mean, a lot of these guys are heroes. But the crime is it's out there. I mean, they say here, as alleged, the defendants defrauded hundreds of thousands of dollars into millions, capitalizing on their interest in funding a border wall to raise these millions of dollars under the false pretense that all of the money would be spent on construction. And this was the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney Audrey Strauss commented on that. And they now say they have all kinds of sham invoices and accounts, and, you know, they must have some sort of evidence. I don't know. So here's the question. I've had a lot of people in my ears the last few days, And I don't really know what to think about this story, truth be told. And I'm curious if you have some thoughts. People are suggesting to me that this is politically charged pretty much at this time to bring him down. So versus legitimate charges and the accusations of what's being alleged here, draw some contrast for me. What are your thoughts, please?
Well, I'm like you. I don't have any real concrete answers as to what's going on here. I am very concerned about the timing of it. I mean, how long have they known about what they believe to be, what the allegations are about the, you know, essentially what is the theft of those funds from this supposed charitable endeavor to raise funds to build the wall? The timing of it. I mean, this is just about, you know, pretty close to an October surprise. It doesn't look good for the president. The president trusted this man, hired him away from Breitbart, where he was terrific, by the way, as a Breitbart radio host, Steve Bannon was. I listened to him on a regular basis. But the president hired him away to be the CEO of his campaign in 2015, 2016. And now this makes it look like the president has pretty poor judgment. This guy is in handcuffs now. So I do think there is a political element to that. Now, the other side of it is the feds don't usually come for you without boatload of evidence.
Exactly. Yeah.
If the blue windbreakers are at your door first thing in the morning, they are not there to visit and ask for coffee. They've got a lot of stuff on you. And so it isn't going to look good. I believe in due process. I believe in innocent until proven guilty. But I am very concerned about how this makes President Trump look just, 75 days or so before the election. And quite frankly, it makes conservatives look bad because Steve Bannon has been a stalwart voice for conservatism. He's a Navy vet, truly has been, pro virtually everything that we talk about as a conservative platform. So it is embarrassing, and I just hope it isn't something that harms the president this November.
Yeah, they typically don't come to the door. They don't move to this level unless they have something exactly. Bannon's going to have a fight of his life ahead here, clearly. The timing is quite ironic, very much so. The impact of this and the bigger problem, I think you would agree with me, Bob, is not even what we've talked about already, but it's what we haven't talked about, the media spin. Already, I've seen a lot of headlines trying to tie this, as you say, to one of the president's men, which is what they're so good at. But I think you would probably agree with me, Bannon, he has got a hell of a fight of his life ahead, doesn't he?
He does. And, you know, and I don't know whether I want to say I wish him well or not. It depends on whether he's guilty. we don't know that. But yeah, he's got a heck of a fight and it'll be very interesting. I mean, you said it. The media is going to run with this. They're going to say, just like Roger Stone, just like Paul Manafort, just like General Flynn. You know, they're looking at all of these Trump associates or Trump campaign people or whatever roles that they played and how many of them have faced federal charges. Now, never mind the fact that they entrapped Michael Flynn. Never mind the fact that what they did to Roger Stone was so over the top that it forced a presidential pardon again so they can take shots at the president for that. The media will milk this for all it's worth and make it appear as though Trump hires criminals or Trump hires decent people who become criminals when they work for him. That's the media spin, and it's going to be very, very important for the president to get the truth out there. And by the way, to point out that he did, the president, quickly part ways with Steve Bannon when he realized, you know, this guy is not really what I want representing me.
That's exactly it. And that's what you have to do. Tremendous thank you to Bob France. What a great perspective and analysis he has on the issues. Really a privilege to have him with us here on Viewpoint. And up next, again, we got the great gamble of COVID-19 vaccine development. Stay right there. More Viewpoint in just a moment.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio. While the World Health Organization hopes the coronavirus pandemic will be shorter than the 1918 Spanish flu and less than 2 years, the WHO chief, Tedros, said this on Friday, in fact, and he said, if the world unites and succeeds in finding a vaccine. And that is the place to start here. I'd like to start there with Dr. Peter McCullough, please. He is an internist, a cardiologist, an epidemiologist. He's authored over 500 cited works in the National Library of Medicine and lectured across the world on contemporary medical issues. He's got a fascinating article in The Hill, The Great Gamble of COVID-19 Vaccine Development. Looking at the worldometer right here as we speak here, I mean, it is over 23 million cases worldwide. Deaths are over 800,000 and recovered is, approaching 16 million right now. And of course, these numbers change very rapidly hour to hour, day to day here. There seems to be a big rush, which we've been hearing about, the vaccine. To get this rush to vaccine, the president has spoken out about it. Many others have. There's a lot behind the push for that. And you say it's one of the greatest gambles in modern history with, again, billions of dollars are being spent. Hundreds of thousands of lives are being lost and an unimaginable misery, heartbreak and human suffering is the message here. So let's talk and start with this vaccine. And are we rushing to get a vaccine out there? And how comfortable are you with the process?
Well, thanks for having me on the program today. And we're about 6 months into what's considered a once in a 100-year pandemic. So there's no playbook on how to manage this problem from a medical science perspective. The public health messaging from certainly administration in the United States, but also academic experts, has been to wear a mask, wash your hands, and wait for a vaccine. And by doing that, the gamble is really taking focus off attention and development of acute treatments for COVID-19. So we've heard almost nothing about treatment at home for COVID-19. And this is very different than what other countries have done. But I think the major point to think about is that economies such as Japan, Russia, India, they've moved very quickly to use oral medication at home to treat COVID-19, and they are not having the disaster that we're having in America with respect to mortality. United States is in the top 10 countries in the world in terms of deaths per million population, and we have one of the most sophisticated medical delivery systems in the world. So we're clearly doing something wrong, and in my view, we're missing the entire opportunity of treating COVID-19 at home.
Okay, so let's talk about those medications that you suggest that we should be looking at, and then I want to dive more into the vaccine itself. So what? Back to the early treatment and the aspect of treating this, and not just waiting for the miracle to happen, which you say, which is a vaccine. What are some of the medications you're suggesting?
Well, in Japan and, Russia, India, they've moved forward with a drug called favipiravir, which is an oral polymerase inhibitor. It's approved to treat influenza, and it does have some activity against COVID-19. We don't have it available here in the United States. Keep in mind, the United States isn't alone in this no treatment at home, wait for the vaccine approach. Canada, the United Kingdom, Spain, Italy, and France are all doing the same thing that we're doing. And I think history will tell the tale that we took a wrong public health approach. What doctors can do right now in the United States, and I've published broadly on this, and I'm very comfortable in doing this in my practice, at the initial onset of symptoms, I waste no time in recommending the use of over-the-counter zinc, as well as prescriptions to help reduce viral replication. And the prescriptions include hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin, or doxycycline. After about 5 days, or if there's any pulmonary symptoms whatsoever, I recommend the use of a steroid medication, prednisone. If patients are at risk for blood clots or developing signs and symptoms of blood clots within the body, I recommend and treat patients with anticoagulants. These are all the same approaches that are done in the hospital. My suggestion is to move these 2 weeks earlier into the treatment course where they can be far more effective and not have patients wait at home in sheer terror for 2 weeks with COVID-19 before they become ill enough to require hospitalization.
So in the early test and back to in the early prevention and doing this at home, what is the success rate for you that you've encountered? I mean, is it in the stratosphere? Is it really high or is it just moderate?
Well, we can rely on countries that have done this. For instance, in France, there's a large cohort where this approach has been taken. And of course, it's refined over time based on new knowledge and studies. We have thousands of papers now published on COVID-19. But the success rate there is far in excess of 99%. Hospitalizations can be avoided.
Wow.
And the inference is that mortality is markedly reduced. I can tell you with no treatment at home, there's only one potential outcome, and that is patients will either spontaneously recover or they'll get progressively ill and require hospitalization. They have no chance of modifying that outcome without treatment.
Yeah, it seems to me a lot of people have minimized this early and late business, and I'm really puzzled by it because it's not real hard. It's not a stretch of the imagination that with any disease, doctor, I mean, anything at all, including cancer, for God's sakes, when this, you've got to get it early. I mean, if you don't get the meds in you early, I'm talking whatever it is. I mean, if it's a common cold or flu or something as serious as cancer or a heart problem, you want to get it early. But for some reason, the pundits and the media operations and the people against this don't seem to understand this with COVID. They seem to be fine. As you say, you send them into the hospital when they're on their deathbed, and then it's too late. Put them on a ventilator, and then you've got the skyrocket in death. What am I missing?
Well, 75% of people who become hospitalized with COVID in the United States never required the ventilator. So I think a large proportion of the hospitalizations and the overrun of hospitals is completely avoidable. It's not happening elsewhere. It's not happening in India, Russia, or elsewhere because they're taking a treat-at-home approach. These countries can't afford to overrun their hospitals. Here's the problem. The medical community in the United States, as well as Canada, UK, and other countries I mentioned, are taking a very disciplined approach. The disciplined approach is to wait for randomized trials to deliver a clear and definitive answer. We're 6 months into this, Malcolm. We don't have a single randomized trial that's been definitive. My estimate, it's going to be more than 2 years before the randomized trials weigh in. So in my view, doctors can use, and patients should demand it, they can use drugs that we believe have a reasonable expectation of success that are safe and efficacious. It's not a stretch to think that, for instance, early on in the infection, the virus is replicating. Some drugs to take the edge off viral replication may or may not work. But I can tell you, 5 days into it, when patients are coughing and having difficulty breathing, that's similar to an asthma attack. And we would treat that with prednisone or steroids, no questions asked. I don't see any reason why that can't be done at home for patients with COVID-19.
So in this first 6-7 months now, as all this has been going on in the rush to vaccines, a lot of people, I mean, they're asking me, have double-blind studies been used at all with the use of placebos? And, you know, what about, again, where's the knowledge level of this? And you're suggesting that none of that has happened. Is that correct?
Now, all the trials to date are flawed. The trials for remdesivir used in the hospital, and certainly favorable to the idea of using an antiviral in the hospital. One trial with remdesivir showed it was completely ineffective. One trial showed it's modestly effective. But keep in mind that none of these trials are large enough to be definitive. With hydroxychloroquine, there's been mixed results. With azithromycin, there have been mixed results. Doxycycline data are on the way. There's an anti-inflammatory called colchicine, and there's a large randomized trial that's about a third of the way recruited, 2,000 out of 6,000 patients recruited. But in my view, the tension is, should we let people die now, or should we advance treatment ahead of randomized trials? And again, there's no playbook on how to do this in a once in 100-year pandemic. You can tell that I'm on the side of treating now and letting the randomized trials refine our approach in the future.
Amen to that. That is well said, for sure. You know, based on what you're telling me right now, you do not sound confident at all. I mean, from what I've just gathered, that we would have an effective vaccine, certainly by the end of the year, which is being promised, and even the first quarter. You believe this is going to take time to get right. And if we look historically at vaccines, many of them have failed miserably. So is that the concern? Have I labeled that properly, or...
Well, keep in mind, the last time we had a Manhattan Project on a vaccine that was successful was the polio vaccine in 1962. We were unsuccessful for vaccines for major outbreaks, MERS, SARS, AIDS, hepatitis C, on and on, Epstein-Barr virus. So it's not easy to develop a vaccine. So far, the data are promising with a whole variety of vaccines developed by companies. Keep in mind, the federal government has injected billions of dollars into this. This is a giant investment. This is not trivial. And the vaccines can generate responses in the test tube where antibodies have been generated in a body, in a human body, and the antibodies show in the test tube it can neutralize the virus. Having said that, there's a lot more to it. Don't forget the antibodies in the back of the mouth and the nose are IgA antibodies, which cannot be, that response can't be measured in a test tube. And not only that, with so many patients having COVID and having asymptomatic infections, it's possible the studies may recruit patients in the studies that have already had COVID, and therefore a vaccine is not going to show any differential benefit. So I think there's a very large chance the vaccine trials will fail, even though vaccines may show a modest antibody response. The U.S. government will, and the FDA will probably approve a vaccine like they did in Russia, probably rushing it to market. It'll be partially effective, and we'll still have many questions about how many lives could have been saved with early at-home treatment.
Wow. Yeah, I'm thinking it's a confidence factor and a fear factor within the American public to what you say there. And, you know, once these directives come down from the very top, I think people are really concerned. Before I talk about the money, and I have a couple of questions on that, I want to ask you something that I am very puzzled in, and I don't know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you and hopes you do. There's a lot of talk, and there has been talk from the beginning, Doc, about herd immunity. I keep hearing, and I understand the concept of herd immunity and potentially where we were going wrong up front in this pandemic. But where I'm puzzled in, how does that happen? How do you ever really get herd immunity if you lock everybody up? If everybody is in lockdown mode and there's just nothing happening, I mean, in my mind, you are delaying the inevitable, I think. And I'm really confused with this. Talk to me about herd immunity, how important that is, back to what you're talking about with the antibodies and all. But do you see where I'm at, the puzzle?
Yeah, once there's a large fraction of the population of the virus, and keep in mind, many young people never have any symptoms, 70% or more of the population, then individuals can't pass it to one another because they become immune, so-called herd immunity. And so the frequency drops down. So you're right. As people shelter in place and home and are taking all these precautions, they're setting themselves up for the possibility of getting the infection. And they are, in a sense, retarding herd immunity. Now, having said that, with a virus that is potentially fatal in individuals over 50 and those with comorbidities, we shouldn't encourage intentional infection. So I think herd immunity will happen. One, the strongest estimate I've heard is that of each documented case we have in America right now, there's 80 individuals that have probably had it and the case is not documented. So if that's the circumstances, we may have a third, maybe even half of our population that's already had it. And that would also markedly limit the potential market for a vaccine.
Right. Yeah. Because once you've got that, you're then getting up over the hurdle, which is where we've got to get to the other side of this thing very clearly. Listen, the last thing I really, really so want your impression on, the money trail. You know, they always say, if you really want to find out what's behind anything, just follow the money. And with this, from what I understand about this whole vaccine business, it's not just big pharma, but there's a money trail of beneficiaries here of this massive undertaking. Can you tell us briefly who they are and how does this play into it all, please, in developing the vaccine?
Well, keep in mind, many of the advisors to the federal government are very much promotional of vaccines. There are project directors at the National Institutes of Health that hold patent positions on vaccines with companies. There are laws in place to say the federal government can actually reap the financial benefits when the government holds patent positions on vaccines. And if you are a vaccine manufacturer, you've already been injected with a large amount of cash. And some of these are pre-manufacturing the vaccines before we even know if they're effective. I mean, this is a large effort that the ship has left the harbor, so to speak. But if you can imagine a vaccine manufacturer and you wanted the most lucrative marketplace possible, you would have a population like America, Canada, the UK, other leading countries, have the population shelter in at home in complete fear, offer no at-home medications, and have that market prepped for a mass vaccination program to reap massive amounts of profits. So this is set up to be one of the largest biotechnological profiteering enterprises of all time. And it may be effective. It may truly help the population save us from COVID-19. But boy, this is really has the setup of conflict of interest through so many different levels. And I do worry about the next patient tomorrow who gets COVID-19, where the guidelines from infectious disease experts who are all receive financing from vaccine companies and from up and down the federal government, branches of the federal government that's involved in this, the guidelines are no at-home treatment, wait at home in fear, and wait for that vaccine.
Yeah, well, that is incredibly well spoken, and a big thank you to Dr. Peter McCullough. And I got to tell you, I learned a few things, and I hope you did out there as well. But certainly, he is so well spoken about the real issues. But it's important to get this information out there to educate the public, because there's so much bad information, there's so many untruths. I do, at another time, would love to expand further with Dr. Peter McCullough to talk more about some of these other issues within the vaccine, because there's a lot to say about it, as you can already hear. But listen, you can do the math pretty quick yourself, people, and understand what the ramifications are. And if you've just listened to that in that full segment with the doctor, you are far more advanced and knowledgeable about what's going on. Well, up next in the second hour of Viewpoint, Michael Johns will join me. We'll talk about the DNC convention, questions about Biden and Harris that have not been asked but should be required to answer, and the corporate dollars. What is the movement behind this Marxist movement, and what's happening with the fascists and all of this in America's cities? That'll be up on Viewpoint Presents.
Thank you again for joining me on the mission here. It's time to get involved and get loud.